to another Global Crossroads conversation with Chris Smith and the author Mo Tejani.
Global Crossroads, the book. We're now into section three, called Brain Freeze, the overhaul section, and we're on to, and readers will have just read the second story in section three, called The Beast Within.
That's right.
My name's Chris Smith, Shambles Grew on the internet, interweb, and the other voice you could hear is Mo, the author.
Good to be here.
Good to be here again.
Again.
Now, before we get into, before I dig into your head again, as I try to do for listeners to see what's going on in there, I have a question. It's a little bit to do with writing, is that I understand writing now, I know this is not a novel, this is memoirs, isn't it? And this is a series of stories and vignettes and snapshots.
Right.
But I understand in writing a book, there's certain formulas that some authors take. And one of them is that every book should have an erogenous zone. Is the beast within your erogenous zone?
No, the beast within it isn't, but the schoolboy prank that I try and pull off with my favorite English teacher is. I have a 17-year-old boy with raging hormones. It's only natural.
Okay. So, but listeners will have read this already, so you'll know what I'm talking about. And I reckon this is your erogenous area in the book. This is the one where everybody will flip to first and visualize what you were up to, which is a lovely story.
Yeah, one agent wanted me to develop that into the whole story, and I said, nothing doing. This is not soft porn. This is literary techniques.
That would be interesting, a really long story just on that, because this story actually takes place chronologically. Over quite a long period of time.
Over four decades.
It's 40
years.
Four
decades, absolutely. It starts off from me studying Lord of the Flies, which is a central fulcrum point of the book, of the story, as you well know. It starts off with me studying as a 17-year-old the book Lord of the Flies with my favorite English teacher, and ends with me teaching the book two 17-year-olds at an international school in Thailand at the age of 58.
So 30, 40
so it comes
years
full
later.
Circle, yes. Right. And what happens in between is also an essential part of the story, in that I come up with a fictional allegorical character called Shatani, who lives in my brain.
Let me come back to him.
Okay.
Because I know he's already there, because you mentioned it before. He's in there with a number of other people who've already, you know, Gandhi's in there as well, isn't he? Everybody's in your brain. So many.
Yeah.
When
you have multiple personalities, you also have multiple imaginary friends.
Really?
No, I'm not a schizophrenic, so don't let Chris go that way.
Who said that? Where did that come from?
I'm just preempting that.
Lord, before we go talk about Shatani, who's is it Shatani a man or a woman, by the way?
It's both.
Oh, no, I don't want to go that way.
He's not gender specific.
Okay, I don't want
to... half dog, half man, with eyes of pus.
We'll come back to Shatani. Let me talk about something I can associate with a bit more easily.
Okay.
Lord of the Flies had an influence on you, didn't it, the book?
Not only did it have an influence on me in terms of getting me into the world of books and eventually teaching literature, and of course eventually ending up being a writer myself, it had a strong impact on me because it's one of those few books, given that the book was written sometime in the 50s, it's one of those few books that is universal enough to still be very relevant and applicable today. High school students still study it today, which shows its universality. It uses all the wonderful techniques that writers are so fond of in terms of dialogue and graphic descriptive narratives and a fantastic plot that builds itself up to a climax with lots of twists and turns, and still includes humor, violence, death, evil that people, in this case children, can do, and also, how things fall apart when situations change for the worse, be it for children or be it for adults, which is why it's so relevant in current day modern political events too.
So, do you think the book crosses cultural?
In my,
I've read it as a Westerner,
right.
So I can even visualize the sort of school uniforms and the, you know, the kids wearing short trousers.
Uh-huh.
Do you think it? You know, if you were not a Westerner, do you think the book would still have the same impact?
I would say yes, for one very simple reason. All that one needs to do is to transpose the school uniforms and the British scenario of students and children, transpose that into another culture with their own uniforms and their own situations and their own political upheavals. The book was written pretty close after the Second World War. Wow, we haven't had a Third World War, but we've had a lot of wars in between after the Second World War. So I think it is still very relevant. And I think it's very relevant because the literary techniques that Golding uses in this book are so ample and so well done.
So a good book to read for any budding author if they've never read it.
I think so, especially if you're the kind of person who analyzes the structure of the book and how it's been put together and what makes it so universal in its, not just its content, but in the way it's written.
How weird! You did it as a sixth former at the age of in your late teens. You first were exposed
studied
to the book,
it, yes.
And then you ended up having 18-year-olds yourselves, and you were the teacher.
That's right. So
does that feel weird?
No, it feels like life has come full circle in some ways. Yeah. You know, a lot of my thinking in terms of universal values is much more circular than linear. When I'm thinking of ways to integrate, be it in a development project in the humanitarian aid industry or even dealing with how to deal with your own child, I think circular. You know, when my child is doing something at the age of 14 that I don't understand, I remind myself of what was it like when you were 14? And I realize I was much worse. So I don't get as worked up about the situation that my child is in. You know, that's what I mean by circular thinking. Yeah.
Good birthday present, ladies and gentlemen, for your your sons and daughters.
Exactly.
Lord of the Flies, which you'll buy immediately after you've bought Global Crossroads, of course.
Right.
You had a few quotes you mentioned earlier that you said you'd like to mention.
Well, you know, you were asking about the erogenous zones. I will use a quote.
I knew this was going to be a mistake.
You have to remember, I'm a 17-year-old boy with raging hormones. This British woman who's an English teacher that's come into Uganda to teach us is A, wonderful teacher, B, gorgeous looking, and C, just full of enthusiasm for the world of books and literature. Mm-hmm. She used to start every class by saying something like, "Top of the morning to you, my literature wizards."
Sorry, what accent was that, Mo? I was
trying to be Manchester, but it's not quite there.
Really?
I do realize that. But she was very good at taking the essence of what Lord of the Flies is all about and trying to make it apply to Ugandan society. And that's where the whole structure of my childhood pranks that I talk about take on a different turn. All of a sudden, the book becomes real. It's no longer fiction. It's no longer Golding talking about little school boys from England that got lost on an island. It's about us in Uganda going through the political upheavals that the beastie symbolizes in the book. And the beastie lives in Uganda, and so the book becomes real, which changes the whole picture. That's where Shetani, this allegorical...
You would lead me on to that. I was going to say, this is your beast then. This is Shetani.
Absolutely.
Your beast.
Absolutely. It's me realizing that Shetani lives in all of us. All of us. I mean, literally anybody. We have a good side and a dark side, and the Shetani is the dark side of us. And how this character, this allegorical character, manifests itself in real life, in current political events, is what that 40-year period is all about before I start teaching Lord of the Flies to 17-year-olds at the age of 58.
So Shetani is a dark character, an evil character?
it's the evil that lurks inside of us that oftentimes good-natured people, people with morals, try and suppress constantly in the form of bad thoughts and what have you. But there are people, as we well know, and we've had numerous examples of that in our current history, that not only exploit that dark side, but perpetuate it into action. So that character then takes on the form of a way of trying to explain all the crazy wars we've had in the last four decades, ethnic conflicts, violence, raping of children, child soldiers.
Whole countries.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's, you know, I try and make it make the story in such a way by using the literary technique of making sure that the story of Lord of the Flies runs parallel to the story of what's going on in the real world in the last four decades in different parts of the world, and try and make them go parallel.
So you saw, I know, first, where does the name Shetani come from?
I've never
heard that.
Shetani is a Swahili term for a pre-Islamic spirit, obviously a negative one.
Because it's a bit like Satan, the word, isn't it? It's
yeah,
a bit,
absolutely.
I wonder if the roots...
That's purposeful, too, because it's interesting if you dig into the roots of the word Satan, you will find in Hindi, the word for Satan is Shetan, very close.
Yes.
In Swahili, it's Shetani, with an I. So the parallels of the dark side of humans, no matter what country or culture they come from, are linguistically very similar. As far as they're manifested in the word Satan or Shaitan.
So did you recognize Shaitani when you first did The Lord of the Flies, or was it at a later stage?
No. This is when I'm teaching, as far as this, how did the story come about, when I'm teaching at this international school at Prem in northern Thailand, I start reflecting as we go into the analysis of the book on when I was studying the book. And that's how the story gets created, because I realize there's a parallel here, and there's a parallel not only in terms of how it started when I was studying it and when now when I'm teaching it, but all that's gone on in between.
Yes.
So yeah, I certainly didn't think of it as something, a story that I would write about, until I started teaching Lord of the Flies. In fact, it was written literally within 2 weeks after finishing teaching Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, really?
It just poured out of me.
Yes?
Poured out of me. And I felt compelled to share it with all the other literature teachers at the international school, whether they liked it or not. Because I thought it was so good. A little self-boasting here.
apologies to the head of English at... Prem.
Oh, they loved it. They called me their writer in residence as opposed to a literature teacher.
I like that term, writer in residence. Sounds really nice.
Mm, mm.
It's a bit like the term award-winning author.
Yeah, well, those little accolades come in very handy, because writing is a lonely profession. It's you and the thoughts in your head, and you putting it on paper and hoping that somebody will pick up on what you're trying to say. So when you do get accolades, like winning awards or getting an opportunity to be a writer in residence, it makes you realize that people are listening and that people are appreciating what you've written.
It's a nice positive reinforcement.
Exactly.
Always good for the ego.
Exactly.
Is there I don't want to finish on Shetani, because Shetani is a bit of a... I don't
macabre
know
character.
Yeah,
yes.
Great word, macabre. Yeah, that's a bit of a nasty character.
Hmm.
And he's not male or female, he's not human even.
No, he mutates, he metamorphosizes into different forms and shapes. He creates havoc not only in your head, but also in terms of mental visions of what you can conjure up as the reader in thinking of Shetani. I think that one of the best things I could do in terms of anybody that is reading this story is to ask them to reflect on, is there a Shetani in your brain? How does he or she manifest itself? And what do you do to suppress it, if you indeed do suppress it? Those are powerful questions.
But with the yin and yang principle,
mm-hmm.
if Shaitani is the yin, who's the yang? You know, what if you must have a white knight or a guardian angel in glowing white terms on the other shoulder.
Well, I try to keep away from religious connotations, and I try and make them into realistic characters of world history, you know.
Hang on a minute, you've just described to us all about Shaitani. No. Definitely is not
a
realist.
In your head.
Yeah.
And the antidote, which is exactly what you're asking about, also have to be characters in real life, just as much as Shaitani is a figment of my imagination, in terms of being the cause of some of the major conflicts in our world. Characters that come to mind that I talk about through the story are Krishnamurti, Indian philosopher who had a very different paradigm towards life and where we're going with it. Gandhi would be another example. Nelson Mandela's actions post-jail time for 27 years in apartheid South Africa is another example. Martin Luther King. These are people that have gone above and beyond the call of duty in terms of their moral fiber, their moral dignity, their ability to forget the suffering that they've gone through in life and still come out as positive human beings. They are the perfect antidotes towards people like Shaitani that live in our brain, I think.
Mm.
And I'm sure readers and listeners would have their own, you know?
Maybe, though, your next book should be called Shaitani versus the World. Sounds like a whole book about Shaitani alone would be...
It's very interesting that you mentioned that, because when I was writing, as I said, the story came out of me within 2 weeks, right? Shaitani lived in my brain as a living, breathing character. You know, okay, I know that fiction and reality starts getting blurred after a while, but for those 2 weeks, I really started believing that he's a living, breathing character, living in my brain and perhaps in other people's too.
Okay, I think we have to bring this conversation to a short course. The men with white coats have just appeared at the door.
Exactly. And they have a tight jacket on too.
As we have these conversations, Mo, I think I'm beginning to realize that you could take your stories very, very superficially,
mm-hmm.
or you can actually look, and there's a lot of quite deep stuff in them, isn't mm-hmm. there? There's mm-hmm. a superficial...
Yes,
it
works on both levels. Yeah. I like the ambiguity, and while people that are more entertained by the superficial qualities of some of the things in the stories, that's good for them.
Yeah, they're good yarns.
Right.
Jolly good yarns. Right. Good to sit around the campfire, read them around, share them. But actually, if you were to think
a little more about what they really say, then it might get a little deeper. And of course, my hope is that people would go into the deeper side of things too, as they are reflected in the stories. But hey, to each his own. And once the story's out there, it's no longer mine. It's theirs. Belongs to the reader or the listener.
Never thought of that perspective, but you're right. Yeah,
absolutely.
You're right. Mm-hmm.
That's why you better make it good before you put it out there.
No, you made it good already. I know. Any other points that we should touch on before we bring this conversation to a close?
I think it would help to look at some of the quotes just to amplify a little more about how this story takes its twists and turns. You know, this is me talking about my life in England when I had just become a refugee from Idi Amin's Uganda. And I'm talking about the reactions of people around me in London during the 70s, Maggie Thatcher times, skinheads, what have you. And there's a graffiti sign that I see at Earl's Court subway station that says, "Bash the wogs like clockwork orange."
Mm-hmm.
And wogs being a derogatory term for
Western Oriental gentlemen.
Gentlemen, exactly. Ah. This is the one we came up with, but...
Yes.
As you well know, it was a negative term for people that were not white. Another one that comes to mind is, you know, Shaitani is living now in the States, again in my brain, and I'm living in the States, in the United States. And I said, the flower power hippie generation of the 60s. The flower power hippie generation of the 60s, now in their post-war oriental spiritualism phase, are looking for ways to heal from the wounds of the Vietnam War. And they want to make me their spiritual yogi because just because I happen to come from an Indian origin. And I'm like, I can't play that role. You know, there's a shaitani in my brain too who says, you guys elected Richard Milhouse Nixon, a used car salesman who was a crook to start off with. Maybe you deserve what you got. So I'm not very much of a inclined to be their spiritual yogi. But again, it's shaitani playing havoc, playing the good and bad in my own head, if you like, you know.
This may be a mistake, me asking you this, but did yeah. Nixon have a shaitani in him?
I think so. Otherwise, he wouldn't have tried to bring in the army to come and help him as he was about to be impeached by the Congress.
Mm.
This is not a fact that's very well known, but one of the few great things about the American system, political system, is the military and the legal arm of U.S. administrations are very distinctly separate and have been for at least over a century.
Yes.
Nixon wanted to break that, wanted the army to come in and take over, and the army said, nothing doing.
Mm.
Nothing doing. Yeah. So, yeah, you know.
Okay, apologies, ladies and gents.
Anthony Hopkins has done a phenomenal job of showing the schizophrenic nature of Nixon in the movie
yes.
called Nixon.
Yes.
Brilliant.
Right, back to Global Crossroads, though. What would be good to... actually, I was going to ask you about something,
What's that?
And that was, you mentioned to me that there was a story behind the writing of Lord of the Flies. That might be worth talking about.
You mean about William
Gold? How the book came about.
The book Lord of the Flies
yes,
itself?
Yes.
Well, when I was doing some research on Google and a few other educational websites, I found out that William Golding is sitting by his beautiful fire in a winter evening in England somewhere with his wife. And they're chatting about children. And it's what the wife says to him after the chat. Why don't you write a book about children? That spurs this idea in his head of the Second World War has just come and gone. This lady is talking about, right, why don't you write a book about children? And he concocts the whole thing based on that conversation. Obviously, the man has an amazing imaginative mind, but to concoct from just a simple fireside conversation of the wife telling him, why don't you write a book about children, to Lord of the Flies, which is a classic, is mind-boggling.
maybe that's one of the ingrained qualities of a good author, is the ability to recognize those sparks.
Yes, but not only to recognize them, but then to be able to spend hours on end amplifying them into a story, into a narrative, into a plot, into dialogue, into a classic. And I mean, you know, it's one thing to imagine a great book. It's another thing to write the damn thing, right?
I think we should call this episode... go to Amazon and buy Lord of the Flies.
Yeah, that too. That too. You know, I keep a copy of it, and I've seen the movie as well, the English version and the American version.
There's a very old black and white version, I think,
exactly.
Isn't there? Is that the
exactly.
one? Yes, yes, yes.
And now there's an American version in color,
yeah,
of course. But, you know, again, it's a question of one that can look at it as an entertaining, macabre story on a superficial level about a bunch of boys being lost in the jungle and go crazy. Or one can say, wait a minute, what makes people like Idi Amin be created? Or Pol Pot? Or even the Bosnian generals that created havoc during the Bosnian War? You know, we have so many examples in today's world. Is there a beastie in their head that they don't even know exists? Or if they do know it exists, they just propel it further? Or is it just the stupidity of the kind of world we live in? I don't know. But I love exploring those avenues of thought.
And I think that's a brilliant question to leave with listeners.
Yep.
This recording is one of the Global Crossroads Conversations with Chris Smith and the author Mo Tejani.